Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Rose Podcast. We've had some incredible guests in the last year. In the last however many years, but the last year, we've had some exceptional teachers. We've had some wisdom bombs dropped. And I really wanted to be able to reflect on the year and share with you because, you know what? It's likely you haven't listened to every episode. Totally understandable. But make sure you do hit the subscribe button. Make sure you hit the notification button so you don't miss anything. And make sure you like this video to be able to help support the channel. Because I've got a series of the best of, which I'm so excited. And each episode is themed. And we put together some of the greatest savage knowledge dropped bombs of conversation that I've had. This first episode is near and dear to my very big heart. It's codependency and boundaries. The cornerstone of all of my work is this healing of putting other people ahead of ourselves, which doesn't mean there's not a time and a place for that, but it's like, is our life oriented around that? Am I silencing myself to keep other people safe? Am I minimizing my own power? Am I playing small? All of these things are colluding in someone else's smallness if they can't hold the capacity for our totality. And so these conversations are little wisdom nuggets that can maybe give you some, likely, not even maybe, likely give you some seeds of threads of wisdom that will allow you to see your life more clearly and your relationships more clearly, because the world needs all of you. And at the core of a lack of boundaries and codependency is not all of you. It's the fear. If I am all of me, I will lose relationships. It can be dangerous, right? There's all these things that have been true in the past. If they weren't true in the past, you wouldn't be living them today. But there's that saying that your biography is not your destiny unless you live there. Our past can haunt us in the present moment by the behaviors and choices we make. So it is my deepest intention that this episode give you a beautiful summary of some of the most profound things that have been shared, and that it impacts your life as you go into the holidays, if this is a holiday season for you, and that it allows you to finish 2024 like a freaking badass savage, and that means you're hitting the ground running in 2025, ready to freaking go, ready to create, ready, you know, that you're not spending the whole time grieving anymore. And there's this beautiful transition point that happens when we step out of that process of living in the wound, of living in the suffering, as we start to experience joy and possibility and hope and all of that. And that's on us. No one's coming to save us. We got to save ourselves. And then we save ourselves so that we can be ourselves. And then we can be in relationship as ourselves with others. Greatest gift in the world. The world needs you as all of you. So in this episode, we got Dr. Laura Berman, who's incredible. Dr. Stephen Porges. Oh my gosh. Africa Brooke. Oh man. Sabrina Zohar. Terry Cole. I mean, all of them just absolute weapons in the space of relationship, healing, and all that stuff. I can't wait. So let's dive in and get going. The best of codependency and boundaries. Here we go. I'm curious for, it sounds to me like before we're conscious of actually directing our energetics like this, mm-hmm. our vibration, we tend to match. Right, you were saying we like kind of meet in the middle.
Yeah.
Or we match someone else's.
If we're codependent, we match everybody else's.
Yeah. So, I mean, our new book, that's so good because it's so correlated to my wife and I's new book, which I know we're going to talk to you about.
Yeah, I'm excited about
which
that.
I'm excited, called Liberated Love. And it's really about like how to heal those codependent patterns. And I love what you said, that it's like, that's an automatic dedicated match. So you're like automatically like, in order to be safe, I got to match yours. Because if you're good, I'm good.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so good.
And you don't hold your own.
Right. You don't have an own.
No.
Yeah. And so by practicing this, you then become the tuning fork that other people start to radiate towards.
Yes.
So what does it look like in the 3D, like in our relationships, when we start to develop this raise, this elevation, this ascension, and then, you know, let's say our original codependent blueprint is with mom or with like a sibling or with a partner. What is it like? What can people expect?
Yeah. Well, one of two things will happen. So first of all, you don't have to worry about what will happen. You just do it. And I can promise things are going to get better. I can't promise there won't be moments of bumpiness, but they are going to get better because one of two things are going to happen. Either your partner is going to rise to your vibration, which they very, 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 I would say the majority of the time do. I would have never thought. I mean, my husband, we're married almost 21 years now, and I have changed. There's very little of me that resembles the woman that he married. Energetically, emotionally. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure physically too, but I'm talking about the non-physical. I've changed the rules. I've changed the dynamics. I've changed myself so much. And he keeps rising. I keep thinking there's no way he's going to be able to hang with this new version of me. I'm like, there's no way. I hope he can, but like, I'm prepared. Yeah. I'm so committed to this growth that I'm prepared. And then he rises to the occasion. And I see this in so many people I work with. So more often than not, your partner will rise and match you. Now, as they're doing that, stuff comes up. That's part of what's happening on the planet right now. The electromagnetic field of the Earth, this happened right before NASA reported on it, spiked and has remained that way. And Mother Nature doesn't entrain to us. We always entrain to her. So all of a sudden, we went from as a community, as people, we went from living on this frequency to being pulled up to this frequency. And when in order to rise or raise your frequency, you have to face some shit.
That makes sense. I mean, we got to shake a lot of shit out that's going on.
Right.
There's a lot of old systems, old ways of relating.
Yeah. And people are like freaking out, facing their shadows, which is what happens, because the only way you can raise your frequency on a permanent level is to face the wounds that keep you in scarcity and fear and guilt and shame.
Right, right. Which, like, low vibration, quote unquote. But like how that looks in the 3D is not handling conflict well, having no boundaries, not keep maintaining your own energy.
Yeah.
Or as Terry Cole would say, taking care of your own side of the street.
Yes.
That's your frequency.
Yes.
Take care of your goddamn frequency.
And so
hear me?
That's true. So everybody is in that state right now. Now, in your relationship, what will happen is you're not going to go from here to here, right? You're slowly raising your own frequency, or you're raising it in relation to moments with your partner. So eventually your whole baseline will move up. But if you can live in those higher frequencies anywhere from curiosity and optimism up to bliss, if you can hold that 51% of the time, your entire universe will change for the better.
Sounds like David Hawkins too. Like
it is map of consciousness.
Yeah.
I use him a lot in the book. What happens in relationship is your partner will continually match you there and continue to rise with you, or they won't be able to, but you will be in such a higher frequency place that at a certain point, it will be like a no-brainer. You know, like you feel whole and confident in leaving the relationship, you know? And for some of us, the pain of being in a dysfunctional relationship where one or both partners aren't willing to rise and do the work to rise, the pain of being in that is, you know, the fear of it, of leaving it, is not as great as the pain of being in
it. Like the recognition of the awareness of what you're actually now having to, you're conscious to the suffering.
Yes.
Of staying.
Yes.
And the thought
and
of leaving is actually liberating.
Yes.
Even though challenging, of course.
And you can't imagine that right now.
Yeah.
As you start this journey. But that's what I see. And I've done this with thousands of people time and time again.
100% aligned.
Either they
on that.
Rise and meet you, or it is so abundantly clear. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's an easy decision.
That's really interesting, because in my own relationship as someone who creates on social media, that I found myself hitting the ends of my capacity, and actually realizing recently I've announced that I'm going to be deleting my Instagram account, and my Instagram and my Facebook, I have over 1.2 million people that I reach on it. But I have to tell you, from a nervous system perspective, a friend of mine was saying to me, well, why don't you just create a healthy relationship with the platform? And I said, I actually, after 3 years of evaluating, in the speculation about it, I've been on there for 10 years. I was like, I actually don't know that the platforms are designed to have a healthy relationship with. They are, there's no, and these specific platforms are interesting because they're unique in that they don't compensate the people for the content they create that does well. So there's not an exchange like a reciprocity that a human would experience. Instead, if your business is built there, now you're reliant on it. And if anything changes on it, I'm in fear all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, did I get the right algorithm? Did I get, and I personally don't want to operate in that way because it feels like I have to constantly be in fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Like
you're really rephrasing it as that you're constantly evaluating the platform, your relationship. Yeah. So you're describing it. And I find social media in many ways despicable because it's not the same as being vetted by academics in a peer-reviewed journal. It's something else. It's where people have, it's democratizing, but not necessarily in the beneficial way of democracy. It's like saying, it doesn't matter what you say, it's all the equivalent.
Right.
And being an academic, that is not the values that I at least grew up with. And then I start seeing comments, let's say comments on polyvagal theory that have nothing to do with the theory, just misunderstandings and literally people not being nice and being inaccurate. And you start saying, why are they doing that? Or how do you deal with this? And you can't, you get on those platforms, you basically go into their level and you start getting into the mud. So I just never went into that. I just stayed within quote peer reviewed journals. You know, it's like saying I'm not in that space.
Well, do you think from a nervous system perspective, we even have the capacity to operate in those spaces in a way that?
No, because so if we use you as an example, and you're really saying, what is it that is affecting you in your attempts to create a relationship? You can articulate it's non-contingent, meaning that you can't do anything to regulate the other side of the relationship.
Yes.
And what that means, if it's non-contingent, it's unpredictable, which is also what you're saying.
Yeah.
And that triggers in your nervous system a sense of fear, which is really someone evaluating you or evaluating the quality of your work or your community without any recourse, without any feedback into a system that would self-correct itself.
That's exactly it. And initially what led to that pathway of making that choice was that I was just feeling into like, why do I have some form of resentment or dysregulation with? And I was like, oh, it's because I feel powerless in relationship to it. And then I was like, well, why do I feel powerless? And I was like, oh, I feel powerless because the way I operate in relationship to it is giving away my experience of discernment and choice and power. And so I was like, well, I played with the, can I have someone else manage it? But here I would thought to myself, ethically, can I hire someone else to date an abuser? Like, you know what I mean? And granted, I understand that everyone's going to have a different experience with it and maybe different capacity for it. But I don't know that there's, I think we're going to look back and see social media, especially for young teenagers, as being like smoking.
Oh, yeah, there's a type of addictive behavior, but there's also this glorification of being an influencer, even using that term. And what does that mean? It means a lot of people click and have you maintain that space. So it's not even in a sense a product, it's monetization of the clicks. Yeah. So it's not quality. It's a strange world.
It really is.
I mean, for you, okay, so you're a couple decades younger than I am, but the issue is it's certainly not the world I came into.
It's not mine either. I'm 45.
Yeah. Well, I'm somewhat older than that. and the issue is I'm watching what I say through the rearview mirror. And the beauty of being, let's say, still cognitively functioning after many decades is that you can literally see how these things are progressing.
Yes.
And part of me is in basically sitting back, not with anger, but with kind of a exploratory curiosity of how does a system, and I'm very in my mind, think in terms of a true system, which has its own feedback and own adjustment. How is this world, or let's say the world of social media, is it going to adjust? Is it going to be vetted, or is it just going to shut down and create some other type of portal?
Would you say, I'm curious your thoughts, for the people who control, let's say, the algorithm, and they're on the other side of this relationship, and they're monetizing my dysregulation, right? They're creating this power structure so that I do the things they need me to do so that they monetize more attention, essentially. Yeah. Do they not experience dysregulation from that? Like, would they? I mean, it's almost like a sociopathic behavior if you're not noticing the empathic.
We don't have to give it a clinical diagnosis. Yeah, all we need to do is say, is what is their motivation?
Yeah.
And you know what their motivation is. It's the monetization, meaning the activity. So disruption, which will make you feel bad, ups the click rate.
Yeah.
Right? So they are, in a sense, there's a degree of elation because the product for them, if they're mentally, let's say, stable, they're not going to get involved with the content. Their product is really the clicks. And so they're going to feel, oh, this is just great.
Yeah.
But if you have, in a sense, the humanistic aspect or human, like empathy or caring and feelings when people say outrageous things and you say, we live in a world, we used to live in a world that the community itself would regulate outrageous statements if they weren't valid.
Yeah, and not anymore.
No.
You know, there's just so many false ideas and boxes that people have to force themselves into, and we're seeing the impact of that. So for me, the third perspective, I think of it as an invitation out of that binary, a realization that there are more options available to us than we are made to believe there are. And I think I would never have thought that I would write this book, actually, because I would have been too terrified to write this kind of book. I would have been too terrified to write a book that says we have gone to such an extreme and we need to reject it. I would have been afraid to say that, actually, as a Black woman, I don't see things in the way that I'm told that I need to because of my race. I would have been so afraid to say that as a left-leaning person, I reject a lot of things that I'm seeing from the so-called left. I would have been terrified to say any of those things.
Yeah, me too.
And they're not, right? And they're not everything that I'm saying, but there are parts of my story that I have been told should either be silenced or just kept in my mind, or they're not to be externalized, you know? So I started writing this and wanting to explore the subject of brave expression in the age of intolerance in 2020. But I would say everything started before then. I was on the internet from 2016 in terms of me sharing my story and building the platform that I have today. And that was because I needed to get sober. I was struggling very, very much with alcohol. And it wasn't just alcohol, but there were so many other drugs that came with it. I'm so grateful that I never had the urge to try harder drugs like heroin or crack or anything like that. I always had resistance to anything that was harder than your typical party drugs. But from when I was 14 years old up until I was 24, I had a very big problem with drugs and drinking. And, you know, I've shared my story so many times, but each time I share it, even those specific years of my life, I always get full body chills because I'm taken back to exactly what it felt like to be in that level of darkness at such a young age. And now as a 31-year-old woman, I realized just how young I was. I realized that I was a 14-year-old girl, 18-year-old, 19, 20, and just living so dangerously. And in that timeline, I relapsed 7 times. I really did try my very, very best to get sober once I realized just how bad my drinking was, because I would black out pretty much every single time that I drank. And I'm not just saying that in a hyperbolic way. That's exactly how it was for me. From 14 years old, I drank so quickly and so much that I trained myself to drink in a very specific way. And that carried on for a decade. But I really did assume that everyone blacked out. That was my assumption until I started to share with other people and realized that actually it happens to a small amount of people, not as many as I thought. But that part of my story is very important because it's really where I got to see my own contradictions. When I wasn't drinking and I was sober, I was pretty quiet, kind of reserved, not shy in any way, but just quiet, a little bit more reserved. And I could be reliable. I could be there for other people. I didn't lie. I was quite uncomfortable with lying. But when I was drunk, when I would sort of turn into this other version of myself, there would be this, almost like all of those parts that I was repressing, all of those parts that I was told were bad, that I shouldn't be angry, that I shouldn't be sexual, that I shouldn't be playful, that I shouldn't be X, Y, Z, insert whatever thing is. All of those parts of me could actually finally express themselves when I was drunk, when I was fucked up. And I really got to witness just the duality of me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that was such an important thing. And I can only really honor it now in retrospect, having been sober for nearly 9 years, because I think it's why I've always been quite comfortable in understanding other people's shadow as well, because I got to see my own at such a young age. And even before that, my father was an alcoholic as well. And I remember, this was back in Zimbabwe where I'm born, where I was born and raised. I remember him coming home and me and my siblings and my mom never knowing what mood he was going to be in, because if he was drunk, he would be all of those shadowy things, even though sometimes that shadow included him being so excited and giving us his work papers to draw on or whatever it might be. He's just in a fantastic mood. Or sometimes the shadow would be him being so angry because maybe he's gambled and he's lost all of his money, or whatever resentment he had towards my mother was coming to the surface. We just never knew what version of my dad we were going to get. So when I sort of play my story back even more, I realized that actually I got to see my own contradictions in my addiction. But even before that, I got to see them through my father. And yet I loved him, but I hated him just as much. And all of these pieces of my story are so important in shaping the person that I am now, because my work, decades on, has led me to a place of wanting to, or rather encouraging people to embrace their own contradictions without excusing anything. Embrace your own contradictions, because it's going to help you understand people with opposing worldviews. It's going to help you understand the people you disagree with. It's going to help you know how to navigate other people's shadows online and offline.
I know a lot of people, for me, had historically, they don't really say it anymore, said like, your work would be so much more valuable if you didn't swear. And I'm like, but then it wouldn't be my work. It would be the work you desire me to have.
And it's funny because I got that just this morning. I got, I don't want to listen to you. I keep swiping because the F words ruin it and you're classless and cheap when you use them. And I was like, actually, there are studies that show that if you saying fuck more often is actually a higher sign of intelligence. Thank you. And what I hear is, I actually hear quite a few other things. I hear I'm uncomfortable by something that you are saying. So instead of just saying I can extract, okay, so this person might say this word, I can extract that out and but hear the message, right? And so it's like, I get either you should stop cursing and you should change the way you speak and you should speak slower, because apparently that's just how humans work. It's just, you should do what I want you to do, then I'm going to do it. And what I've learned is, okay, well, this also makes sense, because the people that come to me are typically people with more anxiety. And a lot of people with higher anxiety, instead of looking and saying, hey, let me see what it is that I want and need, and instead of trying to change other people to get it, because that didn't probably work out very well with your parents, let me just then maybe won't turn it inwards. Instead, it's the no, you need to change because I don't like this. So I want you to do what I want. And what I've learned at the end of the day is like, then you're not my fucking people. You are not the people. Like, I am not going to bat for somebody that wants me to change who I am and the way that I speak and teach, because then that means we're not jiving. That means I'm not able to be authentic. You want to be able to show up authentically, but you're not allowing me to do the same. And so I've just kind of learned, especially with everything, like I had to learn that lesson the hard way in dating. Not everyone's going to like you. And that's totally okay. But that doesn't mean that like I don't still love myself and that I can still show up authentically and just keep walking along with the people that support me on that. And I feel like you probably can relate to that as well, with people constantly wanting you to say something or do something or act in one way. And if you don't stand for something, you truly do fall for everything.
Yeah, I've never thought about the correlation to the people who are drawn more to explore that kind of work tend to be more anxious, which you're right. The pattern of anxious attachment is to try to make the environment finally accept them, finally change, finally be enough that it will orient around the wound rather than heal the wound, and then your environment, you're allowed to choose what you participate in. You know, so it's almost like there's an absence of discernment that's available. And it's like, I wonder if this is actually indicative too of how on a more global scale, we seem to be anxiously attached, like in how we orient to information on the internet. You know, the idea that we want you to stop speaking a certain way, or I want that person to stop posting certain things, or I'm going to go police what people post so that other people don't get protected, don't get injured by it. To me, I'm like, man, that's just so codependent. It's like, you're spending all this time policing the internet. Just stay in your own shit, like clean up your own lane.
That's kind of how I feel about the Are We Dating the Same Guy Facebook groups. I understand the origin.
Okay, I'm so happy you're bringing this up because I've actually had some thoughts on this. So please tell people what they are and then let's get into it.
So they started by one woman and it was like she was just trying to see like, okay, like I understand. Listen, I have been in the trenches. I have dated. I have been single for many a years in major cities. Like I am the last person that's going to be like, I don't know what you're talking about. There's great people out there. Like, I get it. There's some shit. But these Facebook groups were started of like, hey, you know, I'm dating this person to see a like, or am I dating somebody that's married or whatever? And it's like, okay.
I get that.
On paper. I get right, that on paper right. Because it's like, sure. But here's the other thing. If I'm dating somebody that's married, I'm probably going to fucking pick that up because like there are certain cues or certain things like, are you making time? Are you making effort? And I'm not saying that if anybody's ever been duped that you're a moron, not saying that, but I'm just saying if we can try to at least expand our horizons that maybe sometimes when somebody love bombs or comes on really strong, it's like, yes, that's where it's masked. But if you really go slow, you have your boundaries and you're starting to pick up on some shit. But anyways, fine. These Facebook groups exist. The problem is, it's like, you know, this is why we can't have nice things, because what might start as something being innocent of like, hey, just trying to help other women to like not get hurt. What ends up happening is it's a complete shit show. It's everybody, like people posting photos of these people, posting phone numbers, posting names, like that's just wildly inappropriate. And what broke my heart is like they had this article that came out that like there's a lawsuit going against these groups because a lot of the guys are like losing their jobs. And it's like, and of course I see the comments of like, wow, men finally have to take accountability. Sorry to hear. And it's like, all right, girl, first of all, you sound fucking salty. Second of all, the issue is everyone has different experiences. I love my partner to the moon and back. The girl before him that dated him, I could only imagine after he was telling me, I said, what happened with you guys? He was like, we were dating for like a month and a half. He was like, she wanted me to text her a bunch. And he's like, it's not my thing. He was like, it's the same thing or like a month. He's like, it's the same thing I said to you. It's not a sign of my disinterest. I'm not interested in texting. I'd rather spend time with you or hop on the phone. She went bananas. Like I saw that he showed me and it was just like, his text was just like, hey, like, I really like you. This is just, and she sent like 100 more of just like, how dare you? And blah, like going off on
these
him.
These are
and
so my he just needs. How dare you not honor them? And it's like, we do have a choice actually.
Well, you're asking for relationship shit from somebody that you're not in a relationship from. Like, I'm sorry. I don't need to make you part of my day-to-day life when I don't even know your middle name or what you're allergic to. Like, there is no reason for me to be responsible for your anxiety because you're worried I'm going to leave you. Like, heal your shit, work on your stuff. But that's not my responsibility to take care of. Like, I'm here. I'm showing you my interest in the ways that align with me. So I could only imagine if she had gone to that Facebook group, what an asshole. This guy did this and this and this. Because at the end of the day, what we're forgetting is two people have experiences that are going to be triggering to each other that might not be triggering to me. So that girl could have had issues and that's okay. I can honor that. I can hold space. Like you have your stuff. You
true
deal
for
with
her.
You.
Right.
True for her, exactly. And it's true for my partner. Like he had his reality and his understanding of things. But now, when he and I dated, we didn't trigger each other in that way. We were able to communicate and talk and move on. And I was just a better fit for him in that way. And I had more understanding for his boundary that he set. So if I had looked on that Facebook group and seen, oh, this guy's an asshole and he did this. Oh, now all of a sudden. And like, I've just
now
seen
this
so
guy
many-
can't find a partner because he's now flagged on freaking Bumble, which are there, are we dating the same girl sites? Probably not.
No, because that's why that's the one thing. It's such a double standard. And like, listen, I'm all about my girls. Like, don't get me wrong. It's not like I'm sitting here being like, hey, ladies.
I'm listening to Beyonce right now, you know?
Exactly. It's like, I'm just trying.
Swift.
To me, the work that I do and the reason I started doing all this is because I am tired of the coddling. No, I am not here to tell you, hey, you didn't do anything wrong. It's everybody else and the world is just so mean. It's like maybe actually take some accountability and ownership of your part in this. See your control. What do you have control of, which is yourself, and make the moves according to, like an adult, not a regressed six-year-old.
Even just if the only thing you took away from this podcast was that instead of auto advice giving, you were going to start to ask expansive questions, that will change your relationships. Literally, yeah. That one thing will change your relationships.
Yeah, it would change the engagements in which you have with other people who are used to you just fucking offering right away, or they distance from you because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know? And I think of the richness of actually getting to be witnessed, you know, that like we spend our lives not wanting to be seen for protective measures. And as you said, what a beautiful adaptive strategy that as an adult is not actually contributing to the types of relationships you want to create. It is from a safety perspective, but even that is an illusion, you know, like you're not actually, you don't feel safe because you have to be a chameleon.
Exactly. It doesn't even create safety. But if you look at what you could say instead, like what is expansive questioning or empathic listening look like instead of problem solving or auto advice giving? How do you feel about that? Could you tell me more about that? Is there more you want to say about that? I'm sorry you're going through that. That's a crappy situation. That sucks. Do you want to talk about it? Like, but we're literally focusing it back on the invitation for them to share more, because visually, the way that I think about it, like metaphorically in my mind, is what I want for my friends is a willingness for them to be in the foxhole with me, with being brave enough to let me feel my pain in their presence, to not try to auto fix me like I'm some project for them, because that doesn't feel good. I don't like that at all. And when someone can do it, and it's funny, I know exactly who is capable of doing it in my life. And when the shit hits the fan, they're the only people I want to talk to, because I don't need a strategy. And if I do, I'll ask you. Like I have a lot of great minds in my life. If I need a strategy, I'll ask. What I need is someone who can compassionately and lovingly witness where I am. With the faith, even just saying, I'm not sure what to say right now, but I am here to listen.
Man, everybody, come on now. There's an opportunity to move through this. You said something years ago that I'm guessing is most likely in your book, but that we rob people of the opportunity to truly know us.
Yes.
And that's like, I think about that a lot of like our own over-functioning, one doesn't allow someone else to become an adult themselves. So we like rob them of themselves being able to see that they're capable. But when we're chameleons, no one gets to see us. And that, like, what a beautiful gift it is. And I think we don't, and I love the way you teach all of this, because what you're really like, how you say that, like, we are colluding in this. This is not a, they don't let us be us. We're part of, we're not a victim of that. We are actually not being ourselves.
Yes. And how painful, like that's such a high cost. And in witnessing people, you know, older women in particular coming into my practice, just sort of being like, hey man, I played by the rules. I did all the things. I checked all the boxes. And they're like, is this the way I'm supposed to feel? Is this all there is? And the devastation of that is because you took one for the team so many times. You said yes when you wanted to say no. You did all the quote unquote right things according to society. But the people in your life do not actually fucking know you. And so the existential loneliness that you feel is real. And the tragedy is that how can anybody authentically love us if we never allow them to authentically know us?
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.